From the Sky News Centre at 5, a siege on one of London's busiest shopping streets has come to an end. A 50-year-old man was holed up in a fifth-floor office on Tottenham Court Road, where computers were thrown from the window onto the pavement below. Police drafted in snipers, a negotiator and explosive expert over fears he was armed with gas canisters and holding staff hostage. Commander Mac Chishtis from the Met Police.
After contact with our specialist police negotiators, the man came out of the building and was arrested at 3 p.m. this afternoon. We are currently searching the premises to ensure that they are safe.
Cleveland police have warned residents to keep their windows and doors locked as they hunt a 35-year-old man wanted in connection with two murders. They say James Allen has previous convictions for violence. The body of 50-year-old Julie Davison was discovered in Whitby, while 81-year-old Colin Dunford was found dead in Middlesbrough. His friend Arthur Ward says Mr. Dunford was a regular at the Working Men's Club.
A couple of pints and away he'd go. And he never fell out with anybody, he never argued. Just quiet. We'd have a laugh with you, and he'd enjoy yourself for an hour, and then wait.
Barclays shareholders have rebelled against the huge bonuses the bank's paying its chief executive. Over a quarter voted against it, but Bob Diamond will still get the money. It'll mean his total salary and bonuses will reach nearly £18 million, even though he admitted his bank's performance was unacceptable last year. The inquest into the death of a spy who was found dead in a holdall has been shown a video of a yoga expert getting into a similar bag. The hearing heard the possibility he locked himself inside couldn't be ruled out. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news is Ron Stone, who's Labour councillor for St George West. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, if we vote yes in the referendum next week, is there any chance we'll get a radical mayor in Bristol? Craig Clark might fit the bill, and he's here to tell us if he was mayor, what he'd do to give the city a kick up the backside. May Day is Tuesday next week, and that's the traditional workers' day, so I'm joined by former scientist at Bristol University, Mike Levine. He's now retired and part of Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance to tell us what's in the pipeline. Martin Summers will be taking his weekly reconnaissance around world affairs and fishy stories closer to home. Also, Julian Parry's back to explain his way of clearing up all the bribery and corruption around party funding. What exactly is the rolling referendum? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 degrees Celsius and wet. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, cloudy on Saturday, but very wet and windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, generally cloudy week with some sunny spells, a few showers. Next weekend, the bank holiday weekend, that's the 5th and 6th and 7th of May. Highs of the 10 degrees Celsius, plenty of sunny spells and fairly dry. Great. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. First, the Lopresti report, and the Masonic Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, said on this show 2 weeks ago he would give me a copy of the 2012 Bristol Provincial Yearbook. This lists the membership of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in roughly 50 lodges. Jack also said he'd arrange a guided tour of the Masonic Hall at 31 Park Street, as the Freemasons have nothing to hide. 2 weeks on, no Bristol Masonic book and no offer of a tour. Well, next time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is Ron Stone, who's Labour councillor for St George West. Hi, Ron. Welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, good evening.
First of all, Ron, what brought you into politics?
The trade union movement.
Okay, and why and how exactly?
Sheer necessity and issues that were happening in my workplace, and somebody had to speak up against what was happening.
So where were you working?
At the time I was working in one of the local schools as a technician, and technicians were being asked to, stand outside the staff room and knock on doors and whatever, and yet they were members of staff but being treated very badly. We weren't getting recognition of the role that we carried out, and I changed that policy.
Yeah, well, Labour's run Bristol for many years, and about 8 years ago or so, maybe it's nine, I'm not sure exactly, it swapped over to a Lib Dem city. You've lost the city, haven't you, Labour?
Yes, we've also lost a large chunk of the electorate over that time as well, in relation to various things that the Labour Party got up to whilst in government, and that's the path we're having to rebuild.
So, I mean, surely that's your party's responsibility. Are you not a Democratic Party then?
Yes, we are. But like I say, things like the Iraq War, as you know, was one of the major issues that lost an awful lot of membership of the Labour Party, and with it an awful lot of the foot soldiers and people that went out and worked and campaigned for the Labour Party. And that was probably the most damaging issue to Labour locally as well as nationally.
It sounds to me, Ron, like you lost control of your leadership of your party. How did you manage to do that?
We lost control of democracy in the Labour Party when the Labour Party conference stopped being a conference that made policy, and policy went to the centre.
So how on earth can you be a Democratic Party and yet as individuals you're not actually electing or making those policies yourself? The leadership are simply choosing them. So not only are we delegating our responsibility to the MPs, that the Labour Party, the membership, are delegating their policy making responsibilities to these senior people in the party, such as Ed Miliband.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I can assure you that the old-style socialists like myself are working from the bottom upwards to put some democracy back into policy making.
Okay, so what are you doing, Ron? I want to know. When are we going to see a bit of democracy in the Labour Party?
Well, there is a debate going on in the Labour Party at the minute about reforming the Labour Party, and that's part of that debate. It covers all the main policy issues, education, housing, social services, local councils, etc., right the way through.
I asked you, what are you doing?
What am I doing?
Yeah. What are other people in the Labour Party doing to ensure that the leadership actually represents the membership of the Labour Party?
Well, I think they're learning, and I am saying that the way we campaign locally here is the way to do it, and that is to keep in touch and be assured of what you're doing as a councillor or as a member of the Labour Party reflects what people want locally.
To be fair, I shouldn't really single the Labour Party out for this, because I think all of the three main parties certainly
are... Well, I was just about to say that.
I
think the others are far less democratic than us.
But ultimately, I mean, of course, this does filter down, doesn't it? If the parties that we're voting for aren't democratic, there's a democratic deficit. There's a kind of overhang where the leadership nationally and even possibly locally aren't actually doing what the party members want, let alone the public.
Exactly, but it was conference. It was the ability to be able to change that originally, and we are working back towards more democratic grassroots ideas in the Labour Party, at least.
Okay, I'm also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin, you have been vindicated, I think it's fair to say. We're in a double-dip recession officially this week, and in fact many commentators are saying we've now have had something like 8 quarters of recession. This is we're recovering slower than we did in the 1930s.
Yeah, it's not really a recovery, and it's not even a double-dip recession. It's another recession, which could easily turn into a depression. And that's what's obviously been going to happen for a long time.
Okay, difference between a recession and a depression? Then?
Well, now basically, the word recession was invented in the 1950s because depression sounded a bit freaky. So they came up with the word recession instead. But basically, it means your economy is going backwards in terms of growth. And, of course, under the kind of system we live under, that's pretty disastrous for all kinds of reasons.
Now, it's in an article by Ben Chu, a very good one in the Belfast Telegraph, says economic crisis worsens as Chancellor attacked for depth of cuts. It says Britain's giant services sector, which accounts for 3/4 of the economy, only managed to post feeble growth of 0.1%. 3/4 of our economy is now in the service sector. I didn't even realise that. But Martin, what's the bigger picture here? What's going wrong?
Well, basically, as the government's cuts policy is activated and demand is cut out of the British economy, the private sector, far from rushing forward to fill the gap, starts to freak out and decides to commit harakiri, which is exactly what's happening. So as the public sector gets cut back, the private sector cuts back. And then you get into a tailspin like they found in Greece or Ireland. We're very close to getting into a tailspin, and that's why we need to change the pilot.
Well, we never had a recovery, says Jonathan Porters, who's director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. We've had 5/4 of zero growth.
Well, that's quite right. And we've been told by people coming on this show for 2 years that it'll just you wait and see. The economy's picking up. I mean, I think that one of the problems is that the Labour leadership also were talking in terms of the recovery, what we're going to do with the recovery. There has never been a recovery. There isn't going to be a recovery until we completely change our attitude towards how we manage the economy. And I think that's true across all the front benches, including the Labour front bench. They need to wise up. There isn't going to be a recovery. Forget it.
Well, we've had both, actually, George Osborne today here in Bristol, and we had on Monday, we had David Cameron. So we've had visits from both the big top guns this week to the city. Are you convinced by any of their arguments, Ron, at all, about the future for our economy?
No, at least not from the Tory party.
So how have we ended up in this situation where we're now in, where the leadership of the country seems to be actually making things worse? In fact, you could almost imagine grabbing a random person, even sort of a tramp off the street, putting them in that job, and they wouldn't have done as bad a job.
Well, I think there's lessons to be learned from the States post-war. They had a very similar situation, and that went into major investment in public works to actually keep people in jobs, to teach them skills, etc., etc., and to spend, if you like, and invest your way out of a recession rather than just cut and cut.
But the problem with that, Ron, of course, is that you're just getting further and further into debt, aren't you? So you're storing up problems, more problems for the future.
Yeah, I understand that in the short term that might be true, but if you invest in the right projects, etc., there will be a return on those things. And again, you've got to look at if you're paying people to do constructive work rather than receive unemployment benefit or lose skills and expertise and to be absolutely and totally depressed, then I think you've got a workforce to energise at a later date should the economy pick up from any other reason. It's much harder.
Martin, Michael Ankers is the chief executive of the Construction Products Association, has placed the blame for the slump in his sector squarely on the government cuts. But Osborne has insisted that slowing the pace of deficit reduction would only make Britain's tough predicament worse. Every business organisation, everyone who looks at the British economy from the rest of the world, and I think the British people too, understand that that's not the right course.
Well, that's just stubborn refusal to face facts. Basically... if he changes his mind now, he will look as if he will lose face. So they're basically braving it out. But actually, a previous generation of Tory politicians would say, look, folks, we got this wrong. We've changed our minds. And actually, that's what I would prefer them to do. I don't want to see them crash their heads through the windscreen and take the blame for a complete disaster for the country. I would like to see them change their minds now. They're not going to, but they ought to.
OK, if they've got this all wrong for whatever reason, what could possibly be a motive for that?
Because they represent vested interests in the City of London and elsewhere who are basically benefiting from the crisis.
So who stands to gain from wrecking our economy?
The financial speculators win either way. We should have, once we nationalised the banks in 2008, we'd crossed the Rubicon. We should then have moved towards a more socialised economy. But the wealthy classes in the country can't accept that because they've basically got used to the idea that they run things that everybody else does as they say. They've got to disabuse themselves of that idea. They are one part of what runs the society, and they are going to play. They either play as team players, or we're going to have them out of the team.
Another bit of news this week: that the Dutch budget cut talks could create a power vacuum as a downgrade looms for Holland. So there's been a fracturing in the coalition in Holland at the beginning of this week, and there's now going to be a general election over there.
Well, I think that's very amusing because the Dutch were hanging tough on forcing the Greeks and the Spanish to fulfil various criteria, blah, blah, blah. And then it turns out they can't fulfil the same criteria. They're trying to ram down everybody else's throats and then they have a nervous breakdown. Well, dearie me.
Now, David Cameron was in Bristol on Monday, the Prime Minister, and he's urging a yes vote for city mayors. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Let me ask you this. Does this city's politics let Bristol down? All the evidence is, when this has been done elsewhere, you get a low turnout in the referendum, you get a relatively low turnout in the first mayoral election, but unlike other local elections where the turnout stays low, mayoral elections, the turnout tends to go up.
Now, Ron Stone, you're a Labour councillor up in St George West. David Cameron's there urging us to vote yes for city mayors because the politics, he says, of the city is letting the city down. Now, I would imagine you'd actually agree, at least with the second part of that.
No.
So you don't think that the politics of the city is letting the city down?
No.
Even though your party's not running things?
No. If you look at the cities outside of London, Bristol is the best performing city under the current management of the City Council, under at least two different coloured administrations. We're one of the most successful inward investment cities under that policy. So why do we need a knight on a white charger, so sadly, knocking heads together, which is Peter Abraham's favourite issue in relation to taking Bristol forward? Bristol's doing very well without an elected mayor. We don't need to spend £1 million on a set of elections. We'd be better spending that on holes in the road or the pavements, etc., or maybe even bringing back free swimming or other things in the city. And what has been interesting in the enforcement of our good friend David Cameron turning up is that my electors in my ward and right across the city have said to me that if he's for it, I'm against it, because anything he does never benefits my family.
Martin, we've got an alarm going off in the studio here, but we're going to carry on regardless. Martin, can you just give us your view on this? Because I know you're a no for city mayor person as well, aren't you?
Well, for pretty much the same reasons as Ron. I think there's not going to be enough of a turnout. I mean, when they had referendums on devolution for Scotland, Wales and Ireland, there had to be a 50% plus one turnout to make it valid. And as David Cameron's already trying to finesse this, saying, ah, well, if there's a low turnout in the referendum, and then you get a low turnout for the first mayor, but then later on, it all gets exciting. Well, it's exciting in Northern Ireland already. They get 85% turnouts, but they don't have elected mayors. It's because it matters who wins.
Well, one of the most important...
And that's important. The problem. We haven't got enough power at local level to do things, and what difference would an elected mayor make? But can we build any council houses? Yes or no? Oh, no. So why do we need a mayor? Well, what we need is council houses, not a mayor, isn't it?
One of the arguments for this, probably the keenest, is that it cuts through the bureaucracy. Many people see the city council as massively bureaucratic. If you want to have an extension on to the side of your house, you can understand there's a bit of bureaucracy involved. But if you want to have a louver window or whatever, then you can understand that. But a lot of people want to cut through this and have one person almost to sort that out for people.
No, I'm sorry. Let's be clear about it. Planning and licensing, for example, the regulatory committees won't be under the auspices of an elected mayor. So the bureaucracy, such as it is, and wherever it is, that would remain. If you look at the three issues that people often criticise the city council for, lack of an arena, no tram, and the issue around the city ground planning application, what would a mayor benefit in relation to making that work? One, the arena was where the partner pulled out and left the city council high and dry. How would you get shareholders in that particular company to come back to the table and actually deliver an arena? You wouldn't. What would you do in relation to being a mayor to get the residents of the city to decide to pull down a third of its centre to actually put in a proper tram system that we would need, like the cities of Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds and Newcastle have done. You would get a huge backlash of people wanting to keep buildings, etc. That wouldn't work. And how would a mayor have got 20 individuals who are misusing national legislation to prevent the city ground and its development? What would he have done with those to change their mind? Gone out with a gun and pointed it at them? Because, that it wouldn't work.
Our Lib Dem guest last week was suggesting that there are some people in the city that want to see the city run like a business. They can see that businesses are much quicker reacting to market forces around them than the bureaucracy of the city council, and that to have, it's almost like the chairman of the board, the mayor would be.
Wow. Again, you end up in the situation where you have to ask the question, what is the price of the year of the elected mayor? It's £250,000 minimum for the Prime Minister to get the way you want it, to go round bureaucracy. That's what this election's all about. It's going round the City Council, cutting out democracy and letting people with influence being able to influence things in the city that they want, where people in the local communities will get no form of consultation whatsoever. It would just be wished on them.
Well, by way of balance, we've got Craig Clark coming in just after 6 o'clock, who is one of the pro-mayor candidate people, and he, if there is a yes vote, wants to stand as the mayor. But to sort of look at the practicalities of a lot of this, one of the reasons that people do think that the politics in the city, like David Cameron was earlier saying, needs sorting out, is because we've got quite a lot of assets which have been closed and then have just been left literally to fall to pieces. One of those, many people will know, is up Gloucester Road. Yes. It's the Bristol North Baths. And a couple of weeks ago, some people decided that they'd had enough of the place being left for the last 7 years to fall to pieces, and have moved in and started clearing it up. So let's go now on a trip up Gloucester Road to Bristol North Baths, where I spoke to the people inside earlier this week.
My name's Justin, part of the Recession Bristol project. What we're essentially trying to do is utilise some of the empty buildings in Bristol during this recession period. In a lot of cases, the owners of the buildings just don't have the money to look after them. We've taken on the role of caretakers and stewards of the building from a heritage angle and to prevent scrap metal theft.
You're providing free security, aren't you?
So that's absolutely it. We looked at this very carefully beforehand. For 24-hour security on a building of this size, it would cost roughly between £40,000 and £60,000 a year for 24-hour security. That's a lot of money just to have someone in the building sitting there twiddling their thumbs.
And now, Bristol North Baths has been empty for something like 7 years now. I mean, everyone that goes up and down the Gloucester Road will know it. It's now got buddleia sprouting out of the roof and out of even the front facade of the building. So it's obviously being eaten into by these sort of pioneer species of plants. It's been that neglected. And also, I noticed you found some survey forms from the original consultation as to whether the baths should close or not. Now, what did those survey... They were just lying around in the building. Doesn't look as if they were maybe used as they should have been, taken back to the council and used as a proper consultation. But what did those forms tell you about the consultation that led to this place being closed back in 2005?
The consultation was, do you want this place to close? What they were asking was, do you want the pool to close? If not, are you prepared to pay a little bit more money to keep the pool open? And you know, all of the people on the forums that we found said that, yes, they were prepared to pay more.
Yeah, they were asking, weren't they, for if people would be prepared to pay an extra 90p to come and swim here.
Yeah, 90 pence per swim to keep this pool open. Obviously, people are saying, well, yeah, obviously, of course we do. You know, people love this building. This is train and teach generations of people how to swim. It's 100 years old this year, and because it is its centenary year, we're just going, well, no, you know, no building of this character should spend that year in this derelict state. So that's one of the key things that spurred us into action. During this interim recession period, until things pick up again, we're trying to reintroduce the community vibe of things in general, where it's like, okay, we've got this derelict building, it's not doing anything. We can re-establish community facilities for free at absolutely no cost to councils, developers, anyone at all. And whenever the recession's over and whenever things are ready to take place again, we will more than happily leave. People are being trained here. They're being trained for free by people who really care about the heritage of things and the passing on of skills. It's very, very important. We have got huge youth unemployment and adult unemployment. Now, the money's just not there. We do have solutions, but it's down to people to look at the reality of the recession situation and work through it.
To look at the reality of the recession and to work through it. Now, Ron, surely that he needs a slap on the back for that, because what he's doing is he's putting together people who have skills but don't have jobs with empty buildings like that and actually doing them up for the council, for the people of Bristol, for free.
Yeah, well, listening, that's the first time I've heard that. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with what you said. But earlier you did indicate that there were sites like this that have been redundant in the city for a long time, and if you like, people have walked away from them. The issue that we've had as a council is the lack of capital monies that we've had to be able to invest or reinvest in reusing that. And then there's obviously the priority of how you see a building and what it might be. I think that's quite a laudable scheme of what he's done. I do understand what he's saying, because in my ward, for example, the old grammar school next to the park stood empty for 10 years. It was set on fire three times, didn't have a roof, had floods in the basement, and it was going to be pulled down and made into yuppie flats. Instead of that, I managed to work with the Sikh community and re-put that building back into community use, not only for their community, but part of that building is a community facility for everybody for St. George. So I understand what that guy's saying. He's right about the cost of security and people twiddling their thumbs. I don't disagree with him at all. It's just a fact that we've been hamstrung by the amount of money, and indeed with the recession and people moving away from buildings, it's left us with a large number.
But it's not money we need, surely. It's imagination. And that's what Justin's brought to the North Baths. I mean, it's a dreadful way to insult the Victorians who built the baths at the 100th anniversary of the place, to have it just collapsing, falling down, with all these plants growing out of the walls, totally neglected. I mean, for most people that go past there, they will be thinking, well, what is the point of the City Council if this is what they do with our collective resources? They're not looking after it.
Well, on another issue on housing, one of the issues that I've got within my portfolio is how do we get more social and council housing into the city? And thinking of this type of building, I want to look for more innovative ways of getting investment monies in from pension schemes to take over buildings like that and turn them into houses for people.
Yeah, but it's built as a swimming pool, Ron. Surely it's going to be a lot less effort and energy to just actually continue. And as we heard there, a part of the so-called consultation back in 2005, people were asked, would you be prepared to pay an extra 90p to swim here? And they all ticked yes, and yet they were completely ignored.
Yeah, well, I understand that. I heard that. I don't know the reason why their eventual 90p offer was turned down, but I think that as a somebody that's gone out and campaigned for swimming in the city, yes, the pool should stay as a pool. What I was talking about was empty office blocks.
Martin, what are your thoughts about using buildings like this and actually putting together council resources? Because I know, for example, the single parent centre not far from here, down by the M32, the people who run that, they just pay a peppercorn rent, literally something like £1 a year, to the council, and yet they are responsible for looking after the building. Do you think that's feasible in the recession?
I think that's definitely a feasible strategy, but it's only a coping strategy. What we really need is investment to preserve the existing infrastructure and to build better infrastructure. And of course, if people choose to defend what little is left, that is fine.
Yeah, but Justin's doing far better than preserving that place. He's actually getting it up and together.
To be fair, I admire what he's doing, but he's only been in there a couple of weeks, and we'll see what happens. And of course, one of the other problems with people taking over places like that is who are they answerable to? And what if they start causing problems for neighbours and so on and so forth? I'm not saying they will. They sound responsible, but you can't just say, oh, it's a free for all. We can't have a free for all on any of this, and that includes the developers.
Well,
what they're saying is the council
haven't looked after it for 7 years, so, and we are going to look after it, and we are looking after it.
That is fine, but as Ron pointed out, the problem is the council, A, doesn't have the power often to deal with buildings which are being neglected. That's the rules from central government, has been for years. And the other point is they haven't got the money to do it. No. There isn't enough resources. That's why we're against a cuts policy.
Well, as I just said, we need
to spend more money, rather than cut back.
As I just said, for example, the single parent place down by the M32, it's costing the council absolutely nothing to allow a group to use that.
That's absolutely fine.
I think it's a 5-year
lease
or something.
Absolutely fine, and that's an obvious way. I mean, I remember all the housing co-ops that I used to know in London in the 80s. They started off as squatters, they became housing co-ops, and then they paid rent and they did the houses up, and they put thousands of people in houses.
Could I give you another instance in St. George West? The old council housing offices on Blacksworth Road stood empty for about 3 to 4 years. And we have rehoused St. George Preschool in that, given them a lease, peppercorn rent, exactly what you said, reusing that building. 62 families use that building now as support for allowing their parents to go out to work. That's what we should be doing. I quite agree with that guy, and I think that's the way forward. We've got to think outside the box. That's the issue.
Okay, another big story this week. The St Paul's Carnival has been called off amid concerns over safety. Organisers say they had to pull the plug because they could not guarantee the safety of visitors. Now, this seems like a sort of no-brainer to me. I mean, how can you ever guarantee safety? That doesn't actually really mean anything. But what's your thoughts on this decision, Ron?
Well, there was some debate in the City Council around the regulation of St Paul's Carnival, because it's got bigger and bigger and bigger. And there was a question in relation to the number of people packed into small areas. That's one of the health and safety issues, and the safe policing of that. And then secondly, there was the ability to be able to control, if you like, excess alcohol and other things. That was some of the, if you like, practical problems of Carnival. Then there is a number of disparate groups within the Carnival structure that got their own agendas, and there is a funding issue each year in relation to how Carnival raises its money. And they went out last year on the basis of getting people to use new technology and text money and support, and that didn't work, and they ended up with a shortfall.
Well, look, if the council can fund the Harbour Festival, surely they can put a few quid aside for the St Paul's Carnival.
Well, they have.
They haven't put enough, have they? And also...
They've given them £50,000. Let's be clear. This year, the Harbour Festival is having to be sponsored rather than fully funded by the City Council for the first time.
Okay, what about the argument, though? I mean, you know, Notting Hill has a carnival, which is much bigger than the St Paul's Carnival, has just the same density of people. Surely this issue over safety is nonsense.
I know that, but I'm not a member of the Carnival Committee. I don't know where, if you like, the internal dynamics of that group is. But there has been criticism on local radio of the fact that the City Council have still given them the money for an event that is not happening.
Okay, Martin, the Ashton Court Festival as well is another one that's died over the last few years. What are your thoughts about this decision on this year's St Paul's Carnival?
Well, I've been to the carnival the last 2 years running and had a fantastic time, so I'm really disappointed. I think it is important, and I think you're quite right to point out if the Harbour Festival and the other high level, if you like, sort of events in Bristol that bring in outsiders and so on. Carnival's a bit more edgy. There's, you know, there are questions about policing and so on, but I think that the St Paul's Carnival is a great event. I've always enjoyed it, and it's a shame it's not going to be on. Let's hope
we've also got another kind of event which is going on in Queen Square at the moment. I've noticed these sort of giant teepees appearing, and it does seem that this if the council can't help the St Paul's Carnival to happen, what is the point of them doing any kind of cultural events?
Well, I think one of the problems with the St Paul's Carnival is it's got a great deal of cultural significance, and there's a lot of politics surrounding putting it on. And therefore, you know, a lot of people are trying to make a lot of points by putting it on or not putting it on. I think St Paul's Carnival, actually, I've been to Notting Hill Carnival many times. I think St Paul's Carnival is nicer because it's more intimate. And in actual fact, it is a jewel in the crown of the city, and I hope it's not going to disappear. That's all.
Well,
I can
apparently
say
it is going to happen next year, but then that's kind of what they always say. Anyway, next story: Bristol City Council's leader Barbara Jank is to stand down. The leader of Bristol City Council's announced she's to step down. Barbara Jank said she would stand down as a council leader and as the leader of the Liberal Democrat group. And I would imagine after the date of the mayoral referendum, there will be an election of some sort within the Liberal Democrats to decide on a new leader. So for the moment anyway, that's not clear about who that's going to be. But Ron, are you pleased to see Barbara out of the way?
Well, you could say yes. I don't think Barbara and I have seen eye to eye on a lot of issues, but I question did she jump or was she pushed? Nobody's really clear. It was a surprise, even to some members of her own group, as I understand it. And certainly the timing in relation to the potential vote next week in relation to whether we keep a council leader, whoever that was or is, Or an elected mayor, I think is highly questionable.
Well, it's a bit like the last story in a way, isn't it? I'm sure this announcement wouldn't have happened today or yesterday, and the same with the St Paul's thing. If there'd been local elections this year, the beginning of next week, we wouldn't have had either of those two stories, would we?
Perhaps not. I mean, I was with Barbara Yank on Points West on Monday, and we were both agreeing that we didn't want a mayor for Bristol. And if she has had her legs broken and been, you know, dumped in the ditch, then that shows that how backstabbing the pro campaign can possibly be.
Well, I think that may be overstepping the mark a little bit there, Martin. But what are your thoughts, Ron, on the overall idea of? I mean, shouldn't Barbara be up for a re-election every year?
What she's saying
is she's not standing this time.
Well, in effect, she is, because each party has an AGM. Every year, and obviously the leadership is either confirmed or changed, and that happens obviously within each of the political parties and groups.
Okay, I'm going to ask both of you now, put your punditry hat on. Who's going to be the next leader of the city council? Who do you think are the big contenders in the Lib Dem party in the city?
Well, according to the Evening Post, it's Guy Pulteney and John Rogers. Our good friend, the executive member for education, is 1,000 to 1, according to the Evening Post.
And my who's that?
That's I'm trying to think of her name now. Sorry, she's so impressive, I can't remember.
She is 1,000 to 1, Tony.
Okay, all right, fair enough. What about you, Martin? What are your thoughts of who
might
take on the reins?
Well, I mean, as a member of the Labour Party, this is a matter for the Liberal Democrats to decide.
We know that, but I'm asking you, who do you think it might be?
Well, I've no idea. I don't understand the internal politics of the Liberal Democrat Party. They've got weirder and weirder as they've got into government.
Well, the previous... I'm trying to think who the previous Lib Dem leader was before Barbara. I think it was Steve Comer. So he's obviously...
I'd like Steve Comer, but I'm not saying any... I'm doing him any favours by saying that, am I?
Get back to work, we hear. Thousands across Bristol are going to lose their incapacity benefits. Well, this is an Evening Post headline. I think it was on Monday, the main front page lead. These people have got to get back to work. Well, if you waited until Wednesday, you'd have opened the Evening Post and seen only two pages of jobs for all these thousands of people who are being told by the Evening Post they've got to get back to work. Anyway, the work capability assessments are carried out by a French company called Atos, and they've been controversial. This is with disability charities calling for them to be suspended. Critics said they failed to identify mental health conditions and vilified disabled people as benefit cheats. The test was introduced by Labour in 2008 in an attempt to weed out incapacity benefit claimants who were judged fit to do some form of work. The coalition government decided to expand the test to existing claimants, and this whole thing about these controversial new tests on existing claimants, Ron, what essentially the Evening Post is saying there is that people must get back to work, but if you go into the detail of the article, they're saying, well, actually there's loads of people now being told they've got to work where there are questions about whether they actually can work.
Yeah, I think the initial idea of trying to sort out, if you like, the benefit cheats that everybody talks about, you know, you've seen on TV, you know, refereeing football but claiming disability benefit, those people have done a great disservice to the most vulnerable people in society. And I think what you've got now with our current administration in London is that they've taken that so far that they basically don't want to have incapacity benefit or benefits of any sort. They just see that as a drain on their particular capital, and they want to make it as hard as possible for people to be able to claim any form of benefit at all.
Well, is this what we were hearing earlier on about, this is from, I think it was Team Lehman last week, was talking about this idea of, Martin, of running Bristol, running the city as a business. Is this the Evening Post kind of talking about
it's
this?
The usual,
people are
it's the usual wasting. Narrative, a business like Lloyd's, a business like Barclays, a business like the City of London, which is absolutely bankrupt. Yes, they want to run it like that. For sure they do.
And what happens to people who are claiming under that sort of situation?
Well, let's put it this way. All that will happen if you take people off incapacity benefits is you put them on JSA. Now, that means they'll have less money, but it doesn't mean that you've got a job for them. It just means they're on JSA and they have to jump through hoops. And in actual fact, what we need to do is move towards what the Greens have been pushing for a long time, which is a citizen's income for everybody, whether they work or not. And people say, oh, you can't afford that. It's actually a cheaper way of doing it than the ridiculous means-tested system we're used to. And of course, it changes the balance of power in the labour market. If people really have a choice whether to work or not, they're not going to accept rubbish jobs from rubbish multinationals and so on, all the rest of it.
But Martin,
and that changes the whole way in which it works.
But Martin, surely some of these people on incapacity benefit are genuinely claiming a benefit they shouldn't be claiming. Otherwise, you know, I'm sure some of these people that have been put onto JSA should have been on there.
Happened in the 1980s. In South Wales, many people ended up in incapacity benefits because they wanted to get the unemployment figures down. So they were encouraged to go in incapacity benefit as a way of getting the unemployment figures down so that the Tory government looked good. And then, of course, they get pushed back from pillar to post again. But, of course, there's no jobs. No jobs at all.
Well, there are jobs out there, at least two pages of them this week.
Oh, yes, indeed. Of course there are. And don't forget that many people who are incapacitated, it's not obvious that they're incapacitated. It's just that when an employer tries to work with them, they realise, no, they've got mental health issues. Yeah? They're actually a bit strung out, and I don't actually want to employ them. Now, if you want to get those people employed, they can be employed, but they've just shut down Remploy, which was actually employing people with incapacity and have been doing it very successfully for years. Now, in other words, none of this adds up. And also the point I'd make, all these cuts in benefits are actually crashing the economy. That is what is crashing the economy. You should be actually increasing benefits at this time, not decreasing them. I know it sounds silly, but it's actually economics.
Now,
and that's the way it really works.
Ron, Thornbury and Yate MP Steve Webbs, Minister in the Department for Work and Pensions, he's saying that support is available to those who are told to look for work. And he adds that the point is not just to throw people off, it's to say that, are there people that with the right help and support could get back to work? Surely that's sensible.
Well, it seems so on the surface, but because they're propping up a Tory administration in Westminster, I doubt its ability to deliver locally and to actually be, if you like, as apparently democratic or humane as Steve Webb is portraying. I've stood against this man. He is their so-called pensions and benefits expert, but so many things have blown up over a period of years that have proved to be total failures or indeed badly administered or hit and beat the most vulnerable and the most deserving in the wrong manner, that anything that he puts his name or signature to, I have serious doubts about.
Well, it's all very well you criticising the Liberal Democrats, but yeah, there are people like George Galloway are criticising Labour, so let's have a listen to him now.
Okay.
The reasons that Labour voters do not find New Labour credible is because they caused a succession of wars in which more than a million people died, supported by Aronovich, by Yvette Cooper, and by the leadership of New Labour, because all three of the major parties support the war in Afghanistan, all three of the major parties support austerity, as they describe it, which means poor people paying the price for the crimes and the mistakes of rich people and powerful people in running the economy and the government. Most Labour voters say no to all those propositions. And until Labour becomes Labour again, until they can find the vocabulary and express the values that made Labour great, which changed this country. That's why I was in it for 36 years when Aronovich was a communist. I was in it for 36 years because I believed in Labour. And I want to persuade people to be able to believe in Labour again.
All right.
There'll have to be Labour for that to happen.
That was George Galloway. Now, Ron, when is Labour going to be Labour again?
Well, I think this goes back to where we started in this programme in relation to reclaiming Labour and getting back to a socialist agenda that's closer to the communities and the people that traditionally supported the Labour Party. I don't necessarily disagree with a single word of what you said. I think he's right.
OK, on to our next story. Newham's housing crisis is an issue of basic morality. That's in The Guardian, article by Tim Pinder yesterday. Newham's attempts to manage the implication of cuts to the local housing allowance sparked something of a media frenzy this week following an item on the BBC's Radio 4 Today programme. The subsequent debate included a number of excellent blogs, but in the maelstrom, Futures Housing Group's original objection to Newham's letter on the grounds of social cleansing got a little lost. Martin, Martin, we're talking here about 500 families, possibly anyway, being moved from Newham in East London up to Stoke, 150 miles away or so.
Yes, and of course there's no work in Stoke, so of course what we're doing is permanently resigning these people to live on benefits, at the same time as getting them into work, of course, because that's what we're really interested in. Now, if we were really interested in getting into work, we'd build some social housing in London, which would be very much cheaper than putting them all in private accommodation.
It has to be said that these are mostly, these 500 people are almost all, in fact, in private accommodation.
Well,
they?
Indeed, and the private accommodation is very expensive, and the buy-to-let people have done very well out of the boom, and they're doing very well out of the bust, aren't they? But they all live in the shady shires, don't they? And this is the problem. A lot of the free money that's handed out in this country goes to middle class people. It goes to middle class people who are on the housing ladder. It goes to buy to let people. They get thousands of pounds every week in free handouts. Perhaps we should chase them down.
Now, Ron, you're a Labour group in Bristol's spokesperson on housing. What did you make of this story earlier this week?
Well, again, I don't, for similar reasons to Martin, I don't think it's a good idea to export a problem to an area where probably people have got no focus, family issues, unemployment levels are higher, etc. And there is an issue in London in relation to the actual rental levels in London. I mean, they are extortionate, and the answer has to be more innovative ways of actually providing social housing in
But you, you can't actually blame these private landlords for that, can you? Because they're just looking to make as much as they can out of the properties that they've bought over the years, or possibly even still paying a mortgage on. And the demand in London for housing is massive, so they can get away with charging an enormous rent.
Well, they can get away with actually evicting tenants on the basis that they can get a far higher rent with the Olympics coming.
Now, do you think there's any contrast with Bristol, any comparisons between this story and what's going on in the city here, as someone
there's
that
no
knows a bit about
it? There's no plans in Bristol to do this on a wholesale scale at the minute.
But what are housing conditions like in the city, particularly in your ward? Do you have much sort of casework, and do you have dealings with...
There's 14,534 people on the waiting list in Bristol. I got that as an assured figure because there's been anything up to 17,000 being cast around, and I got that figure actually verified. Obviously, it goes up and down on a daily basis.
But there
basis.
Aren't that many people sleeping on the streets, are there?
There's more than it would probably appear in official reports, but no, there isn't. But there's an awful lot of people that are having to sleep on floors or indeed squat off the street, and so there's not a good situation in Bristol. We're only on the benefit of going through and using the system for social housing to be able to build 12 new social housing issues or placements every year. Currently, the borrowing on the housing revenue account is at its maximum of over 70 million. And we cannot borrow anymore. And so you've got to look outside of the box. This is what I'm saying. You've got to find new ways. And I'm looking at ways of trying to produce 10,000 proper units, decent housing for people over a 5 to 10 year period.
But how on earth are you going to be able to afford to do that, Ron?
Well, this is on the basis of what I said before. It was looking at the empty office blocks in a lot of them in the main. Looking at the sites that the City Council owns, and to go outside of the normal funding process, but go to the pension funds and ask them to invest in social housing on the basis that they would get surety on the site, resale only back to social housing, and a percentage of the rents that come off of it as a better return than they get from the banks.
Martin, do you think that there's likely that pension funds would go for a deal like that?
Well, that's the first time I've heard such a suggestion, but Ron is right. We've got to think outside the box to save what can be saved in this ridiculous situation. But of course, what we really need to do is change the central government and get a proper policy in place, which we should have done 30 years ago.
Talking of central government, let's have a listen now to the Housing Minister, Grant Shapps, talking about the situation in Newham.
internet search this morning, I can see within a 5-mile radius of Newham nearly 1,000 properties, which would be in the kind of category that your reporter just mentioned. In other words, within that housing benefit cap of £21,000 per annum rent. So Newham say they have 500 families. Well, even if you accept not all of the properties will take housing benefit, but that was only one website, you start to see that there's probably options.
Now, what he's saying there is essentially that this whole business is just electioneering, because he's gone on the internet and he's found 1,000 properties apparently in Newham which are below the housing benefit cap figure that these people could be moved to within Newham, Ron.
Well, like I say, I don't know the inner politics of Newham or indeed, you know, the basis of that, so I don't feel necessarily well versed to be able to comment.
Martin, would you like to comment on
one simple thing you could do is say, right, they can stay in the houses they're in, there is a benefit cap, that means the people who own the houses will have to accept lower rents, and you can say it's compulsory. Yeah, what about that?
Okay, well, let's have a listen now then to Sir Robin Wales, who's the mayor of Newham. Hear his side of the story.
With Boris Johnson and Ken Livingston, I've said it's social cleansing, so, you know, there's no politics in there. And secondly, let's talk about it on May the 5th. We'll still have the problem on May the 5th after the local elections. This isn't electioneering. We didn't issue a press release. We wrote to organisations to try to get a set of property that people could choose across the country. We didn't issue this as anything like that. We weren't looking at it. We were trying to find a way to help our people, and to help people that are being forced by the government's changes, forced out of central, and we're trying to find a way to help them. We care about it. The government appears not to.
That's Robin Wales there, who's the mayor of Newham. Just to round up, Ron, this looks as if there's a bit of an intractable problem, because if people can't actually afford to stay in the places where they are, they're having to take a chunk every week out of their basic state benefits to actually pay straight to a landlord.
Yeah.
And then they certainly won't be able to afford the money to even be able to move, because that's quite an expensive thing to do. What's going to happen to these 500 families in Newham?
Well, all I can think is that over a period of time, they will become compulsory homeless, on the basis that they'll either get into rent arrears or because they have got private rents of a very high level, and the government is currently trying to put social housing rents up to that level. In Bristol, for example, it's an 8.14% increase this year in council house rents, on the basis of equating those rents over a period of time. And so I think these people are become really vulnerable, with basically nothing else. If we don't think outside the box and think radically, those people will have nowhere to go.
But that 8.1% increase in council rents we've got here in Bristol, surely, yeah, that's a positive thing in a way, because it's the idea is that it's going to help pay off this housing revenue account loans that have been made over the years to actually get that paid off. So hopefully then you can actually start spending some money and build some new council houses.
No, the bulk of that goes straight back to the government. So we're in a situation where we've got no development money, and we can't solve the issues locally, but we are paying off a debt, if you like. But in the long term, because the borrowing issue was getting out of control, it, over maybe a 15-year period, it would end up being better. But in the short term, unless we think outside the box and do something radical, we're going to be in a very similar situation.
Well, here's a man that likes to think out the box sometimes, Martin. This whole business of housing, we hardly ever actually hear big housing stories, and I'm quite glad to hear it, because people actually spend more money on their housing than anything else in their life.
Absolutely, and that's why in the post-war period, Harold Macmillan, the Conservative Prime Minister, was the Prime Minister who built the most council houses of all. Because once you've got lots of council houses and social housing at a reasonable rent, the bottom comes out of the housing market. So the middle class can't just get on the ladder and get their free money from society just watching their houses rise in value. The house prices in Germany haven't risen for 40 years, and everybody has somewhere to live. Perhaps we've got something to learn from the Germans.
OK, on to our next story. And there's a big day for James Murdoch and also Rupert Murdoch this week at the Leveson Inquiry. And certainly it looks as if there's some very dodgy emails flying around. So let's go back to Tuesday now to have a listen to some of the evidence given by James Murdoch.
Managed to get some infos on the plans for tomorrow. Brackets, although absolutely illegal. What do you make of that?
I thought it was a joke. I mean, I think the greater than and the exclamation point there are a wink. It's a joke.
managed to get some info. Absolutely illegal, Martin.
Well, they're squirming around, aren't they? There's more to come.
Ron?
Well, if you look at the Murdoch Empire and what they've represented over the years, I wouldn't believe a word they say.
Well, this email certainly seems to suggest that there was very much a back channel going on between the Jeremy Hunt's office and News International. What does that tell us about Jeremy Hunt?
Well, I think basically that he's trying to hang on to his ministerial position by blaming underlings. And it looks to me as if there is a complete problem in relation to how that link between government and that set of newspaper groups actually operated. It was totally illegal, in my view. It's totally intrusive. It's objectionable. And I don't think you're hearing the truth.
Martin, before we hear your side of this, we're going to go back a year to hear to the House of Commons, right into when this was all a hot issue, whether or not Rupert Murdoch was going to be able to take over BSkyB. So let's go back to the House of Commons last year and have a listen to Jeremy Hunt.
It is a decision about whether a specific transaction is going to affect plurality. And that is a decision which I'm approaching with total impartiality and following strict due process.
Amazingly, that seemed to allow James Murdoch's man to get tip-offs about government thinking on the bid, about private government conversations with the broadcasting regulator Ofcom, about government strategy.
Andy Davis there from Channel 4 News, and Jeremy Hunt in the Commons last year, Martin.
Well, we also had Rupert Murdoch yesterday saying that when he meets prime ministers and so on, he never tries to influence them at all, and anybody who suggests such a thing is crazy.
Can anybody have confidence in Jeremy Hunt when he's clearly shuffling information?
We've got no confidence in any of these people, and of course the point I would make out is, like Berlusconi in Italy, this isn't just misdemeanour, it's illegal. And if we're going to send down 18-year-olds for stealing a bottle of water, and if we catch these people out, they're going down, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Newsnight, Jacob Rees-Mogg also produced quite an interesting email, so let's have a listen to that. He's a local MP here, Conservative.
I've got a little email too, which I thought I might read out. Vince Cable call went very well. Cable said he was coming as planned tomorrow evening. Cable appreciated. We all know that the President of the Board of Trade loathed Rupert Murdoch, he said so to his constituents, wanted to block the bid, and yet this Michelle fellow is boasting to his bosses that Cable is a supporter of Murdoch. He is a PR man who uses emoticons.
So you think he's a liar?
Oh, I think he's not credible.
I quite like the way that Rees-Mogg refers to Vince Cable, the business secretary, as the president of the Board of Trade there. But Martin, what he's saying essentially is that Cable seemed to be playing them a bit of a game, and that possibly that's what that Jeremy Hunt was doing too.
Well, I think that Cable possibly comes out of this with more honour than Hunt, but if he's been in the pocket of Murdoch, he'll have to face the courts as well, won't he?
All right, our final story, and compulsory microchips to be introduced, apparently to curb the menace of dangerous dogs. Dog owners could be forced to have their animals microchipped. Ministers will announce measures, apparently, did on Monday, allegedly, that will allow dogs to be traced back to their owners, who will then be held accountable for the animal's behaviour. Ron, I know you're a bit of a dog fancier. You like going down to Crufts, and I think you show dogs yourself, don't you?
Yes, I show dogs. I judge Crufts this year. And you'll be happy to know that last Saturday I actually got bitten by one.
But what about this measure? Is microchipping going to help?
No.
Martin, can you just give your view as well?
Well, I totally agree with Ron. He's the dog expert.
And what about humans? About microchipping them?
No. I think it is an assistance in relation to lost dogs, but controlling dangerous dogs.
Of course, it's going to make a lot of money for some corporation somewhere if it's compulsory. Anyway, we're back after the news.
Sunday and Motion.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News. From the